Hello, tech lovers. This is the Gadget Show podcast, and I'm Susie Perry.
And I'm Jason Bradbury. Thank you to CEX for sponsoring this week's episode.
If you've got old tech gathering dust in drawers like we all have, give it a new life. Trade it in, turn it into cash or credit.
Yeah, and while you're there, you can pick up properly refurbished kit, phones, tablets, consoles, cameras, the works.
Yeah, all pre-loved, all tested, and all with a 5-year warranty. Head to webuy.com or just drop into a CEX in your area. Hello, welcome to the Gadget Show podcast inbox edition. This is the one where the power shifts entirely over to you. Your questions, your rants, your proud gadget wins, and your absolute catastrophes. Right, we'll get straight to it then. The first question is from Mark Hughes, and it is, what do you think we'll see in the PS6, and are consoles even required now?
Well, here's the thing. That question, you know, is the console dead, is one that I remember addressing regularly during my time on the Gadget Show. You know what I mean, Suze? Like 12 years, I personally was there. It must have come up 4 times. And so it's that, is that quote, you know, that the rumours of my death are grossly exaggerated or whatever. I think that there is a generation of gamers who don't have a particularly powerful PC, aren't really interested in PCs and laptops, but want a game, and a console sits in a non-office space like a front room or a bedroom really well. There is a uniqueness about what the ease of gaming that offers. It's a casual approach to gaming. And I think that's still very marketable today. So I don't see anything stopping with the PS6. I am interested, as you know, though, to know where Xbox is going with their offering. They could go to simply providing software and supporting other people making Xbox consoles like the... God, I can't believe we're going to mention it again. ROG's Xbox Ali and Ali X. What do you think?
Well, I don't think they need to dominate anymore, but they do need to definitely exist. You know, because they're cultural artifacts, really, as much as anything else. You know, those launch nights, exclusives, community. That's why consoles survive. They're not just boxes, are they? They're a kind of ritual,
yeah, I think. They're like the conch at the centre of the community, aren't they? That was a Lord of the Flies reference, by the way. For those listening, because I was miming a conch. Look, I personally can't see a scenario where I'm not owning a console. Because the thing is, the console for me, albeit I've got my Xbox in here, because I was actually wanting to play a game in 4K, and the room that I play in doesn't have a 4K TV. It's got a 2K 1080p TV. But normally my Xbox is in the lounge, right? And it's a social experience. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah.
Maybe the model is the Switch 2 and the Switch, that it's portable and it can output a really decent HDMI signal to a TV. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe they're just going to get a bit less obelisk-like, you know?
This is an interesting question. It's from Ren Mandagorn, who's one of our patrons from Cornwall, from your neck of the woods.
Oh, they're from Cornwall. Cool.
Yeah. This is the question. VR made me sick as a kid, and it still does. Is anyone in VR/XR genuinely dealing with 3D sickness? Now then, this is a really good question, because people massively underestimate how common this is. It's absolutely a core industry problem. And Samsung, Meta, Apple, they all know about it, obviously. It isn't something that they can ignore. And we're seeing proper engineering work now happening in tackling predictability, latency, pass-through realism, and eye-tracking assisted rendering. Because fundamentally, motion sickness is your brain being lied to.
Yeah.
I suffer with this. If the visuals feedback don't line up, then you feel queasy, you feel ill. So the next gen VR XR leap isn't going to be about resolution, it's going to be about comfort. They have to get this right, otherwise it just genuinely won't become mainstream.
I think that's a really good point. I've not heard that made before, that the next generational jump is going to be about comfort. I think that's really quite incisive. I don't suffer with VR motion sickness. I've had moments playing the plank, whatever it's called. It's generally when the motion moves and you don't, and so your brain is confused and sends signals which ultimately lead to nausea. And yes, so I was going to say eye tracking, but you've actually put a much more exhaustively researched list together about the sort of technologies that are being worked on. Yeah, it has to be resolved because you can't have people walking down the street with mixed reality devices, which we believe are going to replace mobile phones, you know, sort of keening over in an alleyway, puking up, can you? It doesn't sell the tech.
One of them.
I watch a lot of VR content on YouTube from some of my friends are really into the VR and they're YouTubers. And it's definitely a thing and they're definitely evolving solutions to it. But I mean, I was in VR last night. I had my Quest 3 on. I was playing Population 1 in my front room. And I didn't feel sick at all. I was climbing up buildings and darting around and looking. I was looking through my scope and doing that thing that you don't need to do in VR, but closing one eye, which is completely counterintuitive. Didn't feel sick at all. Had it on for about an hour. So, yeah. Right. I don't know. So I personally don't experience it, so I don't really understand it.
But I think the point is it will be solved. It's being worked on and it will be solved because they have to. They have to solve it.
Look, whoever cracks Zero Nausea XR, right, so mixed reality, wins the category, don't they? I mean, or maybe not wins it, but definitely boosts their technology ahead of their competitors because they can make that part of the sell, can't they?
Yeah, it would just be, it's a massive, it's opened up the market because you're not going to enter into something that makes you feel ill. Are you? I mean, it stands, obviously, you're not going to do that. Okay, here's another one from Ricky Thomas. Should phones get smaller again? Have they gone too big? What do you think?
Yeah, I think that too. I think my iPhone's way too big. I've got the iPhone 16 Pro, small one, not the Max. And the problem is, look, as a phone, it could be a tiny bar of soap. That would be great. But as a Netflix, Prime, gaming device, internet browser, I want that screen estate. I want as big a, most luxuriant screen that I can possibly fit in my back pocket. So I don't know what are the factors that define the size of a phone, and maybe this is an argument for foldable phones. What are your thoughts, Suze?
Yeah, I think we sort of went with bigger phones because we were watching more content on the screens, and we wanted a slightly larger format, but not as big as an iPad or tablet. Maybe you didn't want to carry two devices around. That's me personally. That's why I went for the bigger format phone. I don't know how much AI will come into this, whether that will dictate smaller phones.
You've still got to visualise. You've got to visualise what the AI is feeding you, haven't you? So this is the real kind of speed bump in making phones smaller, isn't it? Is that as we become much more visual, I mean, all the social media platforms, it seems, are trying to push us to make video now rather than stills. And all content is now streamed, so in meaningfully. So, you know, you can't get too small, can you? Otherwise, you won't be able to enjoy your 4K movie or whatever it is, your game you're playing. What do you think?
No, but, you know, I suppose in the real world, you know, ergonomics matter. Pockets exist, hands exist. There's something to be said for phones, you know, to carry a phone that doesn't feel like a big book. Which I know you find it archaic carrying a phone around. If AI becomes invisible behind the scenes and we might finally get a renaissance of compact devices with flagship hardware again, I don't know. Foldable phones, I know that's not a big thing for you. I'm happy to go back to a foldable phone, just waiting for an amazing one to come along. It's an interesting point, and I do wonder what, you know, whether it will get smaller or whether that, you know, phone, that technology is moving in another direction to wearable devices. So how much is being invested? I don't know. I'm not quite sure.
Okay. Do me a favor. Try and remind me to upload some pictures to Patreon of a phone that I got to play with the other day in a cafe. It's a really cool cafe run by a friend of mine called Luke, who's a tattoo artist. He's dead cool, right?
Okay.
And he bought this phone. It's called the Lightphone 3, I think. I've just quickly researched it because I'm vibing. It's jet black. It's got a sort of screen, but it's very, very, very basic. We're not talking I don't think the screen's even, no, the screen's black and white. It hasn't got a colour screen. And it has simple words in a kind of Helvetica font. So the concept is that it's a minimalist design, all right? And it's supposed to promote a simpler interaction with the phone around music, voice calls, and you can take pictures with it, but you get a black and white image from it in a kind of medium format, like a square image. There's no social media on it. You don't get endless notifications. And I don't think you can browse the web. I've just done a quick search, but this is definitely something that hit me, which is it's small. It's not super small, but it's minimal in terms of its offering. And if there is a cultural pushback, which it feels like there has certainly been the murmurs of, against constant doom scrolling, constant social media interaction, this is an antidote to that. So there may be a sub area of smaller phones that are more just phones than multimedia screens, and that would lead to a smaller form factor.
And it would lead to less wasting of your lifetime.
Yes.
So that's maybe something else we should look at in another podcast. That's quite interesting. Yeah. Just moving on to another question from Ben Turner here. He says, is Android actually ahead of Apple right now? So I would say in terms of speed of visible new AI feature development, 100% yes. Android is definitely moving faster publicly. Samsung, Google, they are shipping bold new ideas and letting users test them at scale. Apple is slower, but maybe more controlled. But as you know, Apple, they always play the long game. So when they drop, it's usually more polished and integrated. What are your thoughts?
I think the Apple intelligence debacle is much bigger than most people realize. I think they sold a lie and they've been found out and their image has been damaged. They followed that up with the whole charger thing, which we've already talked about. I'm referring to their new MacBook not coming with certainly the higher wattage chargers that will give that quick, fast charging functionality that they put in the advert. And I think that, therefore, the fact that Google's offering, certainly with Gemini, is so complete and it's so organic, the AI interaction. There are many other features on Android that I think are knocking out the ballpark at the moment. And I also think that sometimes, you know, Android phone producers can be a bit more experimental than Apple. Apple can be experimental, but you know, their model is generally to sit back, observe, and then to bring a beautiful evolved version of whatever is deemed very popular, like VR and in the Vision Pro, which obviously VR had been around for ages before they did that, but they just sat back and they just got it, you know, in that super expensive niche, they got it right. So yeah, I mean, I think we've talked a lot, haven't we? I mean, I'm definitely in the market to jump from Apple. I said that on the podcast before. People on social media that weren't happy with my criticism of Apple's charging issue were saying that they were saying things like, you're all sheep. You'll never move away from Apple. That was one of the comments by which they meant you and me. I'm not as sheep-like as you might think. And I know you aren't, Suze. And I'm actively considering moving to a different phone ecosystem than Apple, and I'm sure other people might be feeling like that. Maybe we put this one out to the listeners and viewers. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I agree with what you've said. I think it's a lot noisier with Android, more public. They seem to be more on top of their game, but ultimately, you know, Apple do generally play the long game. However, there has been this blip. It'll be interesting to see what happens. I wonder whether whoever wins this AI war, in a way, if you like, whoever wins that, whoever gets that right wins. I'm not sure. It's another kind of, feels like another crossroads for mobile phone companies in a way.
As soon as a technology redefines a sector, like, for example, a lightweight, long battery life, mixed reality pair of glasses, right? Things can change instantly. And so we may well be talking about something that kind of doesn't matter, because I feel we're getting there. With Meta's recent rollout.
I know, that's why when we were talking about size of phones, I was wondering like how much development's going to go into that now, whereas how much is going into, you know, wearable tech rather than phones. I'm not quite sure. I don't think we're privy.
What about Johnny Ives and OpenAI? We should talk about that.
Yeah, go on. That's a question from Dave McKinnon.
I just said that that's relevant for this debate. What give us the question then?
Well, Dave McKinnon says, what do you think OpenAI and Johnny Ive are making?
No way. That's nuts. That's so nuts. What an incisive point to make, Dave. So just for those of you who aren't maybe down with this, Johnny Ive is, of course, famous for having done UK product designer, and he was responsible for the industrial design of the iPhone, the iPad, also part of Cupertino Donut Building, their HQ, and lots of other things. So he's the kind of, well, if he's not been featured at the Design Museum in London, he certainly will be. I mean, he's one of the most significant, he's up there with Dyson in terms of his
super designer,
the effect that his vision has on the technology that humans interact with. And he's been effectively bought by OpenAI. They've done a deal for a lot of money. Him and his team are now working on the world's first AI native hardware product. I think that's a pretty fair way to describe it, which I guess might be like a phone. It might be like a headset. It might be an object that makes AI finally, you know, mainstream in a meaningful way without maybe even calling it AI. If anyone can redefine the sector in the way that I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, it's the pairing of OpenAI and Johnny Ive, isn't it?
It could be like an iPod moment for AI, couldn't it? It could be that massive.
Yeah.
The thing that turns a concept into an everyday object, not a demo, a physical product that you can hand to someone's mum and she just can use it. You know, it's straight out of the box. It does what it says. It's beautiful. I think they're making the first post-smartphone identity object.
Well, I'd put that down. I was just looking at my notes. I'd put that mantle at the feet of Rabbit. Yeah, the Rabbit was this. It's a bit like the Light phone that I mentioned a minute ago, but it's got a much more limited array of features on it. And it sits like a brooch or like something in your pocket. And then it reacts to the world using AI. I think it's got a camera as well. Yeah, it has got a camera. Didn't go down well, though, because I think the problem is as well that AI is evolving so quickly that maybe now a rabbit, maybe they're introducing a new version. I don't know. It says new R1 on their website. So maybe they are back in stock outside the US. There you go.
Ultimately, in answer to the question, you know, if anybody can define this thing, whatever it's going to be, it's Johnny Ive.
Yes, that's the point. But you know what? If you said to someone, I'll give you 100 quid if you can predict what they're going to come out with, I don't know that you could win that 100 quid because I can't think that they're going to come out with something like the Rabbit, right? This sort of square, this rectangular thing that is a bad version of ChatGPT and misidentifies things and also, you know, just doesn't do a great deal more than what a mobile phone would probably do better and provide you with Netflix and, you know, pretty good games. Like, I can't imagine what they're going to come out with. So if you also think, if you say as well, they're not going to come out with a pair of glasses, and there's no reason to suggest that they're not, but let's just take that off the table. So it's not the Rabbit or the like a pebble-like thing. It's not glasses, then what is it? I mean, it's very difficult to predict. And that's not often the case. Normally, you can hazard a pretty good guess, can't you?
Yeah, I think that's why it's quite exciting. I quite like the fact that we don't know.
You're right. It is exciting.
I like it.
Great question.
Let's wait patiently for once in our lives. Right then, time for more top tens, Jace. So this time, I've got the top 10 most valuable retro consoles that you can buy and sell at CEX. Now, there's some classics in here, so can you guess what's in the top 10?
So I'm bringing a console in, and I'm looking at my collection and thinking, what could I take in and get the most money?
Yeah, go on.
Virtual Boy, Nintendo.
Absolutely. Well done. That's number 4.
Is it?
Yeah, released in 1995. Nintendo's infamous stereoscopic table console failure. But Virtual Boy, They will give you £384 if you bring that in boxed.
So next thing would be Atari Jaguar.
Atari Jaguar. Yeah. So they'll give you £241 for Atari Jaguar if you bring that in box. It's number 7. Actually, it was released in 1993, famously marketed as the first 64-bit console. Why don't you stay on your Atari theme?
Not 2600.
No.
Lynx.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, number 10.
Not that well supported back in the day, but tell me.
Well, released in 1989, so it was an 80s baby. Colour handheld with powerful tech for its time, often overlooked, but really collectible boxed, apparently. So you need the box, and they'll give you £141 if you've got one of those. So far, you've got 4, 7 and 10. I think this is quite hard.
What about the fully boxed version of the Nintendo Entertainment System with the guns for Duck Hunt?
You can have NES, the deluxe set with ROB, with Robot. £514.
What?
Yeah, this is number 3. ROB alone drives collector desirability. So yeah, that's why it's number 3.
Yeah, I would truly love that. I'd have that on, you know, on the back wall. So well, in that case, if we're talking Nintendo, I've got to go Super Nintendo, SNES. No. N64.
Yes.
Really?
Number 5, N64 smoke coloured. At £377 boxed, released in 1996, one of the translucent fantastic variants. Specific colourways are incredibly desirable to hardware collectors, apparently.
Okay, I'm now going to move to PlayStation. I'm going to say first-gen PlayStation. It's got to be up there.
Because of the complexity of this, I'm going to give that to you. It's actually number 1. Number 1 is the PlayStation Net, your Rosie console.
Well, that's not what I meant, but I'll take the win. But tell us about it.
Released in 1997, Sony's black developer hobbyist PS1 kit that allowed users to build their own games. Extremely collectible because the production volume was really low, so it's quite rare. But you'll get, if it's boxed, at CEX, £948.
No freaking way. Really? Yeah. I've got first generation Xbox, but it's the Crystal edition, so it has matching controllers. I've got the box as well.
Yeah, it's not on my top 10, I'm afraid.
PlayStation 2?
No.
GameCube?
Yeah.
Really?
Right, number 6 is GameCube, Resident Evil 4 Limited Edition. So 2005, console colour edition, you did mention that. This special edition shipped with the RE4 branding, GameCube plus Capcom horror tie-in, and that's what makes it this cult collectible, and that's number 6.
How much will it get me, that one?
Boxed, £236.
How many have I got left? About 5, haven't I?
You've got 3 to get.
Sega Dreamcast?
No, but stay on that path.
Mega Drive? Mega CD?
I'm going to give you both of those, right? So Sega Multi-Mega Console, that's number 2. Yeah, it's like a rare hybrid Mega Drive plus Mega CD in one unit.
I was about to say, I think it's got a CD compartment in it as well. Yeah, that's very rare.
If you've got one of those, if you were, you know, quite queued up at the time and cute and had one of those, you'd get £671 from CES boxed for that, for your Sega Multi-Mega Console.
If we're on the CD Segas, how about the Saturn?
Yeah. Well done.
Really?
Absolutely. Number 9, the Sega Saturn. CX will give you £144 for that boxed. Released in 1994. Very underappreciated at launch in Europe. Now heavily valued for arcade lineage and growing retro respect.
Give me the top line and I'll see if I can get the actual model. Is it Nintendo?
Yeah.
Okay. Not Game Boy. Not a boxed Game Boy.
Yeah. I'm going to give it to you anyway, look, because Game Boy, it's micro green.
All right, okay, so it's a special design.
Exactly. Released in 2005, the final Game Boy hardware revision, very limited production compared to normal GBA units. So that is number 8, and that completes your top 10. And if you've got one of those, CEX will give you £207 if it's boxed.
Wow, that's so cool. Yeah, well done us.
Well done you. Brilliant. You did really well there. I know you'll be cooking something up for me next
week. You better
believe it. That's all we've got time for the Inbox edition. Thank you ever so much for all your messages. We want more shameful gadget secrets and Yeah. Chaos. Keep them landing. We love them.
Completely. If your robot vacuum has staged a coup, if your smart speaker has started ignoring you, that has definitely happened to me. We need these stories. Get them into us. Drop us a DM on socials, or you can use email. It's contact@northone.tv. There you go.
That's it. Exactly. If you haven't yet, hit follow. Subscribe, because the main Gadget Show podcast is out every week and it has new gadgets, reviews and everything in between.
Yeah, do give us a like and maybe a quick review if you can. But whatever platform you use, it would be lovely for you to interact with us. Comments, faves, always appreciated. And with that, we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
The Gadget Show podcast with Jason and Susie was presented by Jason Bradbury and Susie Perry off the telly. It was produced by Ewan Keel and Tom Clint and is a North One production.